Since Benjamin Spencer was tried and convicted for the murder of Jeffrey Young 3 decades ago, lots of new evidence has surfaced that undermines his conviction. If you've listened to our last 2 episodes, you've heard much of that new evidence, but a jury never has. Yet Spencer's only potential path to a new trial is razor thin. What would it take for this evidence to be reconsidered? And what does that mean if he's innocent? This is Radio Atlantic. Hi, I'm Matt Thompson, executive editor of The Atlantic. Today we're bringing you the 3rd and final episode in our 3-part series on the story of Benjamin Spencer. If you haven't, I highly recommend that you go back and listen to parts 1 and 2. In those 2 episodes, you've heard a lot the jury that sent Spencer to prison did not hear in his trials. You've heard on tape as 2 of the 3 living witnesses who testified against Spencer go back on their testimony to our reporter, Barbara Bradley Haggerty. You've heard about an alibi witness Spencer's jury never knew about. You've heard a plausible alternate theory of who murdered Jeffrey Young, and you've heard 2 of that person's friends say he did it. All of this was enough to convince the foreman of the jury that sent Spencer to prison, as well as the Texas judge who considered his case, that he is innocent. In the next few moments, Barbara Bradley Haggerty will answer the question we started with, the question that haunts a number of people who've heard this story every day. Why is Spencer still in prison with little hope of a new trial? Then we'll be joined by Jeffrey Goldberg and Alex Wagner to discuss Ben Spencer's story and what it says about justice in America. Here's Barbara.
As spring turned to summer and fall to winter, Benjamin Spencer began to worry. After 2 years in the county jail, he asked to transfer back to prison. At least the place was familiar, less noisy, better suited to permanent stays.
I guess I began to lose hope the longer I was in the county jail, because I began to wonder, what's taking the Court of Criminal Appeals so long? And so I'm thinking, they must be looking for a way not to grant me the relief. And so my worst fears became my reality.
3 years after Texas Judge Rick Magnus declared Spencer innocent, the Court of Criminal Appeals rejected his recommendation and denied Spencer a new trial. That's a pretty rare event. Judge Magnus has presided over thousands of cases, and he's been overturned only 5 times. In this case, he thought they were flat-out wrong. But at the district attorney's office, prosecutors were celebrating. Faith Johnson, the current DA, says the decision enshrined respect for jury verdicts and justified their position in the case, which had been a thorn in their side for more than 2 decades.
This wasn't our first rodeo. We've been going at this since, 1987? And we've had 2 trials. We've had writ hearing. We've had the Court of Appeals. So you have all of this that's gone on for so many years, this decision has been upheld for so long, and for one man to say he should get a new trial, well, he was wrong, and that's what we're saying. I mean, we love Magnus, but he's wrong.
The 8 judges of the Court of Criminal Appeals, all Republican, all elected, most of them former prosecutors, required only 21 pages to dismantle Spencer's arguments. The burden of proof had flipped from prosecution to prisoner. Having lost at trial, Spencer is now guilty until he can prove he's innocent. And before he can prove he's innocent, before he can get a new trial, he must provide new evidence, unassailable proof that he did not commit the crime.
The problem was it just wasn't newly discovered evidence. That's kind of what really hurt Mr. Spencer the most.
Judge Larry Myers wrote the majority opinion. We're sitting at his kitchen table, his 3 yellow Labrador retrievers snoring softly at our feet. Bald with a fringe of white hair, Myers seems grandfatherly, earnest. We talk about a key part of Spencer's case, when a forensic visual scientist said that the eyewitnesses who testified against Spencer could not have identified him accurately given the lighting conditions at the time. He says those lighting experts did not offer new evidence, just a new way to look at old evidence. And that evidence, the crime scene at the alley, had changed since 1987. Gladys Oliver's house had been torn down and rebuilt. A new shed had been constructed. Trees were bigger. What about the testimony that another man, Michael Hubbard, was the actual killer? Isn't that new evidence?
Basically, it's just a theory. It's just a proposition. It wasn't conclusive by any means, and it probably wasn't anywhere near as strong as the actual evidence of Mr. Spencer's guilt.
So what would constitute new evidence? Of course, it's a matter of interpretation, since Judge Magnus believed the visual science passed the test. But the appellate court sets the bar higher. New evidence must be something that does not change and was unavailable at the time of trial. The gold standard is DNA. In particular, DNA that's never been tested. But it could also include other irrefutable proof, such as security camera video that's never been seen. Meyer says it's incredibly difficult to win a new trial. The Texas judges call it a Herculean burden. And that makes sense. Think about it. If every inmate who claims he's innocent could win a new trial, the system would grind to a halt. But Judge Myers concedes the bar is so high that innocent people are surely in prison. He's witnessed that himself.
And there's some actual innocence cases where we denied relief that I just went, I was totally I was so mad about that I was not happy about, you know, that we did it, but there's nothing I can do about it.
But if you are Ben Spencer and you are innocent, or someone else and you are innocent, where does that leave you?
Oh, I don't know. Mr. Spencer has been in jail for a long time. Mr. Spencer may be eligible for parole.
But you feel that you all reached the right opinion here?
I hope we reached the right opinion. You can't ever say with absolute certainty. You don't want anybody in jail who is innocent. And I feel like it was the best we could do based upon what was brought to us at that particular time. I hope Mr. Spencer. I'm not saying I hope he's innocent. I'm just saying that if he is, I'm just hope that we did the right thing in this particular case is what I'm hoping, and that Mr. Spencer has hopefully been rehabilitated.
Did you hear that bit at the end? Mr. Spencer has hopefully been rehabilitated. To Judge Myers, what matters is that the court properly followed a legal process. The question of whether Ben Spencer is actually innocent or guilty seems to fall outside of the court's authority. And now that the appellate court has denied Spencer a new trial, his future falls into the hands of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. They, too, have no role in determining whether Spencer is actually innocent or guilty. It's up to them to decide only whether he's rehabilitated. Spencer comes up for parole every February, when the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles considers his petition. But every year, since he became eligible a decade ago, they've turned him down. His supporters are baffled by this. He has a near-perfect record, 3 infractions in 30 years. His co-defendant, Robert Mitchell, was released on parole back in 2001. He died of a heart attack soon after that. The parole board might look more favorably on Spencer if he showed remorse for the crime. But consider what that asks of him.
I mean, it's hard to have remorse for something you didn't do.
The parole board's decision is no doubt influenced by the family of Jeffrey Young, the victim. Young's family has a right to object to Spencer's release. Jay Young says they do, most every year.
If he did get parole, I'd be very upset, but it wouldn't change my life because my dad still isn't. He won't come back either. He's not getting parole.
On February 15th, 2018, just a few days ago, the parole board ruled against Spencer. It's not surprising, since the district attorney told the parole board she believes Spencer is guilty and should not be released. The next time his case comes up is February 2019. The parole board does not explain its decision. The only clue comes from the cryptic statement denying parole based on the nature of the crime.
Well, that's never going to change.
Jim McCluskey of Centurion Ministries.
What happened to Jeffrey Young, as tragic and as brutal as it was, will never change. So I'm just hope and pray that someday the parole board will get tired of denying him and will eventually let him go home.
There is one more route to a new trial, although it's a long shot. Spencer could petition for another hearing. But to get into court, he must find what the court considers new evidence 30 years after the crime, when he's behind bars. All the evidence presented in Judge Magnus's hearing, the lighting experts who undercut the eyewitnesses, the new alibi witnesses, the alternative suspect in Michael Hubbard, even the evisceration of the jailhouse informant, that's old news now. Spencer's team threw everything into that hearing 10 years ago and won. But that means that Texas's highest criminal court has now seen that evidence and decided, against Judge Magnus's recommendation, that it's not enough to trigger a new trial. In that sense, attorney Cheryl Whatley and investigator Jim McCluskey say, the blessing has become a curse.
Ironically, that's the catch-22. We need new evidence. We need the proverbial breakthrough.
Short of an absolute, unforeseen miracle, there's not much daylight.
In reporting this story, investigator Daryl Parker and I dug up some intriguing items that I initially thought might constitute new evidence. For example, we tracked down Israel Williams, the younger brother of the alibi witness, Christy. Israel swears that he saw Ben Spencer at his house with his sister around 9:30 or 10 that night, about the time that Jeffrey Young was being attacked a couple of miles away. If Israel is telling the truth, it bolsters Spencer's defense. Parker also used a new technology called photogrammetry to recreate the crime scene on his computer. Using photos of the alley taken in late 1987, police sketches, and measurements that Parker took this summer, he made a three-dimensional reproduction of what eyewitness Gladys Oliver could see from her window. He plugged in all the natural and man-made objects in the area, trees, a shed, a large camper parked near the alley, and concludes,
"There's no way that Gladys Oliver could have seen Ben Spencer get out of a car."
Armed with the photogrammetry, Parker paid a visit to Jimmy Cotton 2 weeks ago. Remember, he's one of the eyewitnesses who corroborated Oliver's account. Parker told him the computer reproduction indicated that Gladys Oliver might have been lying, and he asked if Cotton had lied as well. Cotton said nothing for a few seconds. Then he told Parker that he did see the BMW that night, but didn't see anyone get out of it. He said that a day or two later, Gladys Oliver told him to say he saw Benjamin Spencer. Last week, on February 13th, Cotton drove to Cheryl Whatley's office and signed an affidavit to that effect. Afterwards, Whatley turned on Parker's iPhone.
So can you just tell us your name, please?
Jimmy Lee Cotton III.
Mr. Cotton, did you testify at Ben Spencer's trial?
Yes, I did.
What did you say at the trial?
I said I seen him get out the car.
When you say you saw him get out of the car, was that true?
No, it wasn't.
What wasn't true about it?
I didn't see anybody get out the car.
So why are you telling us now?
Because it's the right thing to do. He should not be locked up with something he didn't do.
In the affidavit, Cotton states that Gladys Oliver instructed him and another young man in the neighborhood to tell the police he had seen Spencer get out of the passenger seat. We know from police notes that she did direct the police to these two teenagers. You may notice a possible inconsistency here. Cotton told me the police fed him Spencer's name. Now he's saying Oliver did. Perhaps both are true. After Cotton signed the affidavit, Parker asked why he lied.
Because Ms. Gladys said go along with her story.
Why didn't you choose to tell the truth at the trial?
Because they said if we changed our story, we was going to get locked up.
Earlier, Cotton had told Parker that Oliver mentioned a big reward, but officially, at least, he would not admit he lied for the money. So, in the past few months, we've dug up several pieces of new evidence. Let's review. One, Israel Williams confirmed he saw Spencer about the time Jeffrey Young was being assaulted miles away. Two, a digital reproduction suggests that Gladys Oliver's view of the alley was blocked and she could not see anyone get out of the BMW. And now, three, Jimmy Cotton has sworn that he never saw Ben Spencer, but that Gladys Oliver orchestrated the whole thing. Parker visited Oliver at her apartment a few days after Cotton confessed to lying. She sounded confused, he said, and she claimed she could not remember a thing about that March night in 1987. And yet, the DA and the Court of Criminal Appeals may not consider any of this new evidence. It may not meet Texas's Herculean standard to win a new trial. Now, let me get a little meta here. Spencer's story reveals a collision in the legal system, truth versus evidence. It could be that the truth is on Spencer's side, but there's no evidence to confirm it, no path to proving his innocence. In other words, once the legal system finds him guilty, it's as if that judgment is set in amber, and you need an extraordinary instrument, an evidentiary cudgel like DNA, to free him. Benjamin Spencer rises early, around 1:30 in the morning. He dresses quietly, trying not to disturb the 110 other prisoners who share the large dorm room. Each man has his own cubicle with a bunk, a table, and a locker box for his possessions. By 4 a.m., he has arrived at his job as a general clerk in the prison's education department, filing papers and running errands. He works until mid-afternoon. He likes the staff he works with. As to the other inmates, Spencer keeps to himself. He'd made friends, but they've all been paroled by now. He tries not to dwell on what he's missed in the past 3 decades. Creating a family with Deborah, finding meaningful work, helping his parents as they age, the stuff of life that has passed him by.
I tell people all the time, this is not living, it's what I call existing. You exist.
For people who've been involved in Spencer's story, there's something unforgettable about it, something bothersome, a pebble in the shoe. Even for people who think he's guilty, the detective, the prosecutor, the district attorney, the appellate judge, Spencer's case is lodged in their memories 30 years later. Now consider the lineup of people who believe he's innocent. The judge who reconsidered his case, the witnesses who originally testified against him, the jury foreman, Alan Ledbetter.
There's rarely a day that goes by where Ben doesn't cross my mind. I drive by the courthouse where we convicted him each morning in my commute to my office. You know, I have daily reminders of his plight, just recognizing that it's so wrong.
More than 18 months after Spencer had been declared innocent, a few dozen of Spencer's family and friends gathered on the steps of the Dallas courthouse. Alan Ledbetter stood off to the side. A group of teenagers from Spencer's childhood church began to sing "Hard Fighting Soldier," and soon the crowd took up the gospel hymn. I ask Ledbetter if he remembers the words. He frowns, concentrating, a little embarrassed. Haltingly, he whispers the verses to himself, and then closes his eyes.
On the battlefield, I am a hard-fighting soldier. On the battlefield, I keep on bringing souls to Jesus by the service that I yield.
He knows the hymn from his church choir. Sitting with him years later, it's as though he's back on those courthouse steps.
You gotta walk right and talk right and sing right and pray right, right on that battlefield. You gotta walk right and talk right and sing right and pray right, right on that battlefield. I keep on bringing souls to Jesus by the service that I yield.
A white face in a choir of black Texans, the jury foreman who once passed judgment on Spencer and now wants him freed.
On my head, in my hand, the sword and shield. I got a helmet on my head, in my hand, the sword and shield. I'll keep on bringing souls to Jesus by the service that I yield. Ben is my hard-fighting soldier.
In that moment, I wonder once again about the sly nature of truth. There is an answer in this story. Either Ben Spencer killed Jeffrey Young or he didn't. But without DNA or other irrefutable evidence, the facts are hidden. Neither the math nor the emotional intensity helps us here. On both sides, there are prosecutors, judges, jurors, witnesses, family members, and friends who would swear by their position. It's possible we will never know the truth, and this uncertainty comes at a cost, not only to Spencer, but to Jeffrey Young's family, who are the only verifiable victims.
Sometimes people look at this as winners and losers.
Jay Young.
Based on decisions by public figures, DAs, judges, Court of Criminal Appeals. But that's never going to change the fact that we're the losers here, that we lost our father.
30 years after Benjamin Spencer was condemned to life in prison, he and his supporters are left with a battered faith in the justice system. But what of that larger faith? Jim McCluskey says he's never questioned the religious call that redirected his life at Trenton State Prison nearly 4 decades ago. But after spending half his life trying to free people who paid for crimes they did not commit, McCluskey is hounded by doubts in the existence of a just God.
If he's real, or she, but if God is real, then why? What's the purpose? What's the redeeming value of all this unjust suffering? And I don't have an answer. And by the way, I've studied this issue at the seminary. None of the theologians over the millennia can answer that question.
But he pushes through, his faith bent but not broken, because an imperfect faith is better than none. It's a dilemma that Ben Spencer understands well.
I don't want to die in this place. I mean, I don't want this to be my life. I don't want this to be my life's end.
What about his initial conviction that the truth will set you free? He says that's already happened when Judge Magnus declared him innocent.
And that's why I can go to sleep at night, because knowing the truth will prevail whether I ever get out or not. The truth has been said. The truth has been spoken, and the truth has been acknowledged. And although I'm not fully satisfied with that, I find satisfaction in it.
In the course of my reporting, I filed a request with the Dallas County Crime Lab. I asked if they had preserved any biological evidence, specifically DNA, from the crime scene. Spencer's trial predated widespread DNA testing, and no one would have thought to look for it back in 1987. I was stunned to see a notation in the medical examiner's report that the lab may have preserved fingernail clippings from Jeffrey Young's right hand. There is a chance that Young scratched his killer and captured his DNA. I asked District Attorney Faith Johnson if she would agree to have the clippings tested.
Absolutely. Because we don't want any innocent person to be in prison.
It's not clear when that testing will happen. Of course, the DNA could have degraded. It could point to Benjamin Spencer, or it could point to someone else. Without exoneration by DNA, Spencer's future rests in the hands of people who have been disinclined to grant him freedom in the past. Will the district attorney, Faith Johnson, consider or dismiss Jimmy Cotton's recantation or the other evidence we've turned up in the past few months? Would the judges on the Court of Criminal Appeals consider any of this new evidence, evidence that meets its Herculean burden, if Spencer's case ever got to them? For now, Spencer will wait another year, hoping that somehow the DA and the parole board change their minds and deem him worthy of freedom. Because barring a DNA miracle, it seems that Benjamin Spencer has no way out.
Stick with us. In a moment, we'll discuss Spencer's story with Barbara and my esteemed co-hosts Jeffrey Goldberg and Alex Wagner.